It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. This morning we have, I just want you to know right up front, we're going to have Butler Schaefer on. Butler Schaefer's been a regular speaker at the Freedom Summit over the years, and he was the law professor for my partner in the Freedom Summit, criminal defense attorney here in the Valley, Mark J. Victor. Butler Schaefer is, what's the best word for him? Anarchist. Okay. Here you have a constitutional professor, law professor, and he's like, you know, who better to know? You know, that's one thing that we'll ask him. We get him on here. As soon as you got him on, you guys let me know. This one thing to ask him is people that he associates with or people in his position, do they know? I mean, how bad does it have to get before they can, you know, kind of rewire and come to a realization that, we got some problems. We got problems. And who better to ask than a constitutional law professor? I got you there, Butler?
I think I'm an unconstitutional law professor.
Well, tell me, you know, that's one of the first things I want to ask you. There's some stuff I want to get into. You know, your argument on Lou Rockwell, you're making the title of it is Repudiate Government Debt, a Modest Solution, which is, I think, is probably what's going to wind up happening one way or another anyway. But, you know, the thing is that in your field, as you are training the future lawyers of the planet, your peers, the other professors and so on, How do they go from your class down the hall to another class, and the other professors are able to convince them that it's not broke? I mean, I'm wondering, you know, do you have the students on your side, or the faculty want to slap you around? What's going on?
Well, I think more than anything else, I'm probably tolerated there, but by students and faculty alike, but. You know, all I really try to do with the students is to put some alternative ways of thinking into their head. You know, it's just, you know, this isn't the only way of you know, having a society operate. And it's rather clear that the way in which we've been running it, you know, the sort of top-down institutionalized model is collapsing. You know, all of Western civilization is collapsing. I used to say it's collapsing. I think it's already collapsed. I think it's basically over and done with. And so I think we have to start asking ourselves, you know, what better ways can we find to live? And it's an exploratory process. It's not a, you know, here's a magic formula that all we have to do is do A, B, and C and everything's going to be taken care of. It's going to require a lot of thinking on people's parts. And that's what I try to get my students to do, is just to think about some of these matters and to think outside the circle. The circle, but what's contained within the circle ain't working. You know, it's just not.
I got to ask you a question. We're going in the break here real quick. I want to know, have you seen that movie Inception yet?
No, I haven't.
Go. This is right up your alley. And I can sum up the whole movie in one thing: the power of an idea. You know, the inception of an idea. I mean, that's the whole point. It's a ouch, quit it, matrix, jumping around, and then your dream kind of make you thinking thing. But the bottom line, it comes down to, you know, not just extracting information, you know, doing, you know, specialized espionage on someone in their dreams. They come with the idea that we need to plant an idea. Well, the man's been trying to do that from the beginning of time. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone.
and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Hancock, another independence declaring kind of guy, Butler Schaefer from Southern California. Tell me, what's the name of the university college that you teach at?
Southwestern University School of Law.
And you've been there how long?
33 years.
Whoa, I'm almost that old. You know, the one thing, I mean, I really, really want to delve into, you know, what you're trying to do is to create what? You know, critical thinkers? I mean, somebody, you know, the people George Carlin's going on about we don't have anymore? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, mainly that, just to kind of open up the thought processes. You know, our school systems have been so horrible, not just the government schools, not just grade schools and high schools, but the colleges as well. When I was in college, there was some pride taken in the idea of a liberal arts education, and this meant, you know, you would develop some familiarity, some intelligent familiarity with a wide range of fields, from philosophy to history to literature to the sciences and so forth. And there's so little of that. I see so many students coming into law school that, you know, they were communications majors or journalism majors or political science majors, whatever it is, but with very little background in terms of substance. And when I was in law school, I was spoiled, but I basically learned my economics in law school from Aaron Director, who began the whole law and economics program. We had Carl Llewellyn, one of the big minds in the whole field of jurisprudence, was also an anthropologist. We had people on the faculty that were widely read and quite knowledgeable in a variety of fields. And now law schools generally are kind of just career-oriented. You know, how can we get you through law school so you can pass the bar exam and go out and practice law, but without the kind of perspective I think is really, really required.
Well, how bad has it gotten over time? As you have 33 years, you're getting students. That means that you're getting students in the 70s? Yeah, we got it down.
I started here in about 77. Yeah.
So you start getting students in, this is when I was in high school, okay? So mm-hmm. you're getting students then. I kind of remember the days. You know, it's the Cold War is heating up. We have Carter in. We have inflation things starting to go. Interest rates rising, gas prices, you know, Iran hostage crisis, Iran, Afghanistan, Iran, Russia, mm-hmm. okay, Ronnie Reagan, and so on. Then they come in, you know, the economy starts to take a hit, you know, they're, you know, Volcker gets in, they raise interest, I mean, same kind of, I mean, if I had, about three quarters of the headlines from then, same as what there are now, except now.
Mm-hmm, pretty much. Change the names and so forth.
Now, a lot of the names are the same. I mean, it was Rumsfeld and Cheney and, you know, and Bush. And, I mean, oh, my goodness, the same people.
Underlying institutional interests are the same.
Absolutely. So we have this continuation of, and then they kind of put it in a bottle and they pushed it off. And then they took all those problems, bottled them up, and then dumped them on this generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at education as the government schools coming from 33 years ago up to now. And you mm-hmm. see the product coming into your classrooms, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What has been the trend? Was there any bright times there? Was there hope? Was it continually getting
better? Some of the brighter times are right now. And I think earlier on, 25, 30 or so years ago, when I would get into some of these kinds of questions, people just shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, we're not interested in that. Today, you get a lot of young people who, and Ron Paul had stated it very well, he said if the schools haven't done anything else, they've at least taught them arithmetic. You know, these kids can figure out what their future is. They're not so much concerned about the fate of civilization or of all mankind and so forth, but they see that just for their own lives, that, the whole system's just going to swallow them and all of their property and their income and everything else up. And So when I get into some of these discussions with students and raising some of these questions, they listen. They're interested.
Because they see it. They're living it. They're feeling it. Is it? But I mean, we started the Freedom Summit, Mark and I, in 2001. Now, Mark was one of those students for you back in the early 90s. You know, I mean, was he common or uncommon? Were there other minds like that?
There's never a situation in which I would say Mark was common. You know Mark.
Yeah, I know Mark.
I think what happened, using Mark as an example, I think what happened is that some of the things I was getting into triggered something within him, and he was just discovering aspects of himself he hadn't discovered before. And I think this is basically what learning does. A good facilitator, if you want to put it in those terms, is someone who helps you discover something that's already within you. And one of the problems that you have with younger people today, the good side is that they recognize that there are very severe problems that they're going to be facing. The downside is that the school systems have not prepared them intellectually to deal with these things. They don't understand economics. They don't really understand history, by and large. I mean, and speaking in very general terms, of course, but not all of them, very few of them, have the kind of background in the sciences that I think are important. Science, after all, is one of those subject areas that's difficult to fake. You know, you can't compartmentalize it into different political organization groups. You can't have such a thing as, you know, black physics or chemistry for women or, you know, biology of, you know, gay behavior, whatever it may be. You know, the laws of physics work no matter who you are, where you are, and so forth. If a black man and a white man both jump off a building, you know, they're going to have the same fate. And it doesn't matter what...
I never thought of that before. It kind of leads me to the conclusion that that's one reason why they don't focus on it. I mean, they need to... That's common ground. We don't have common ground. We want to have separate ground.
Well, and you have the one of the things with living in a highly industrial, scientifically driven world, you can't operate a kind of technologically advanced, engineered sort of universe on the basis of whims. You know, you have to understand what's going on. If you're going to try to accomplish some scientific objective, you have to take the world as it is. Public opinion polls aren't going to change that.
You know, we got plenty of time. We'll get in. We got the whole show get into your article, so I definitely want to get into that. But, you know, I still want to spend some time on, as a law professor, what is it actually that you are teaching? I mean, they come into your class and they walk out of it. They learned what? You know, how to file a motion? I mean, what are they looking to do?
Well, basically, what I'm there to do is to help them learn basic legal concepts. I mean, that's 99% of what we're doing in class. I teach, the main area that I teach in is property, and so they learn the basic concepts of property law. Along the way, when in discussing a particular case, for example, we use the case method to analyze cases, we'll compare one case to another and see if they can pull out of it certain principles that apply. But in doing that, you get into such questions as, you know, what are the economic consequences of a rule like this? If you had a rule of law that said everyone would have to walk around on their hands, what would be the economic consequences of that? What would be the human consequences of that? What are the consequences of a political system premised on the use of torture? What does it do? How do we analyze it? Do we just analyze it in terms of dollar and cents cost associated with it, or is there some kind of a moral or ethical vein that we have to get into? And if you're going to get into that, how do you do it? Especially when you have a school system that has not encouraged you as a student to inquire into that. You know, you're being encouraged for the most part in the schools to figure out a way of making a living within the system. And that's essentially a kind of a pragmatic undertaking. pragmatic in the narrow sense of the word, but the philosophic principles and the emotional responses to things, the schools aren't terribly interested in getting students to examine that because it doesn't have any meaning in our institutionalized world.
You know, this is one thing I want to ask you about. You know, there's a couple of things. I'm glad I got you on. There's a lot of things that's been in my head, and you're the guy, and we're going to share it with the audience. You have a practical outcome of certain things. And when we come back, I want to talk about, is principle or philosophy, is it always practical? I mean, it's kind of a shortcut to, you know, when you violate someone's property, you know, their life, their liberty, whether you can put it on a spreadsheet or an Excel right then, will there always be ramifications that'll eventually show up there anyway? And, you know, can you just shortcut with what we perceive to be right and wrong? We'll be right back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my very special guest and friend and rock star, Butler Schaefer. You know, that's one thing. When we, this last year, and since certainly the Lovevolution and so on, and a lot of attention being paid to your writings and such on Lou Rockwell and everything, you know, you got a lot of college-age kids that, you know, man, they're just like, damn, you know Butler? And I'm like, seriously? So I guess you have a big influence, man.
Yeah. Well, I think the ideas are. I think that young people are open to this right now. And I, for the reasons I stated earlier, I gave a talk at an economics conference in Las Vegas a few years ago. And I'm guessing there are about 400 people there. And these are all mostly academicians, either college students or college professors in their early stages. And it was all very, very much a free market, libertarian / anarchist kind of crowd. And I would say of the 400 that were there, at least 80% of them were under the age of 40. Now, this tells you something about where the future is going. And I think that I was noticing this in the 2008 presidential campaigns, and they would have C-SPAN or someone else would be covering live various candidates. And here would be Ron Paul speaking to a group of young kids, you know, 20, 25, 30-year-old kids. John McCain was speaking to crowds of, I shouldn't say crowds.
People with walkers, yeah.
Yeah, with their USS Missouri baseball caps on and, you know, almost all of them in their 60s, 70s, 80s, so forth. So which way is it going? And I think that the political establishment recognizes this. They recognize the danger to the political order in particular of things like the Internet, where people can freely communicate with one another. And so they're going to try and put a stop to all of that, slow it down, control it, use the kill switch if need be.
You know, I had Declan McCullough from CNET on yesterday, and I've had Declan on for probably 7 years, back when he used to just do Polytech, you know, his own little, like, newsletter thing. Huh? And then he goes over to CNET, and then CNET gets bought up by CBS, and I go, see, you railed against the man, now you are the man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he's going, well, I go to these hacker things, and I go to the, and they're just, nah, I don't really see that they're going to, and they're, I'm going, Declan, they got Kool-Aid in the water fountain or something? I mean, I don't understand what. Well, you know, it'll be hard to, you know. And the one question that I asked him, and I anticipated just from the past couple of years of him going down this hole, you know, kind of where he'd go on this, is that the reason we were so supportive of, like, Spaceship One and private space travel and a lot of things that's going on is because we knew that that meant that private satellites without government control, or you get it put up by New Zealand or Sri Lanka or, you know, Timbuk, whatever, they put it up and you have, like, Iridium. You know, the satellites are sitting up there waiting. So I'm going, you know, we go ahead and have a private network. we don't need the internet anymore. It's just separate. China doesn't have to put in all this infrastructure. You know, India doesn't have to, you know, lay all kinds of telephone lines and yada, 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 yada. Uh-huh. We go off planet. And you know what his answer was? He goes, well, they could just shoot them down. And I'm going, wow, wouldn't that be something we need to know?
And isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting that whatever it is that benefits mankind generally, whatever it is that humans want to do with one another in terms of communicating ideas or just, you know,
a threat,
chocolate cake recipes, whatever it may be, is suddenly something that's of a threat to the whole institutional order. But I think we have to remember that institutionalism, and this is what I've really focused on for many years, including my Calculated Chaos book, it's institutionalism that's the threat. It's the idea that once we've figured out a convenient and effective way of doing something, we want to keep doing it. And the problem is that the whole life process is very changeable. You know, you have to be able to be resilient enough to respond to changes. Well, institutions don't like to do that. They like to kind of keep things going the way they are. We invented the assembly line, and so therefore all manufacturing should take place on an assembly line. Well, we said that's not working too well. Or the processes for manufacturing steel. You have these great big steel mills in places like Pittsburgh and elsewhere that just can't respond. They can't be resilient to changes coming from other technologies.
You know, the one thing that you brings to mind when you say that is that not only do we find institutions that want to keep on keeping on in the name of the institution, they even forgot why they created the institution.
Oh.
But then they want to compete with it. Everybody's got to, well, we got to have a bigger, better, faster, stronger, younger institution. You know, mm-hmm. I give you Campaign for Liberty. I mean, you know, as much as they have a problem with whatever it is, they'll just, you know, recreate the same thing and just put another label on it. And I'm going, any collective, even with the L on it, you know, a libertarian, is still a collective. You know, they got to stop thinking this way. And one thing from the end of the last segment, I made some notes I want to go on when we come back, is, you know, right, you know, being correct. Is that always practical? I mean, you know, is it a shortcut to just, you know, you determine some base knowledge of what is proper? How do we, you know, what is that? And how does it apply in the future? We'll be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Of me, Ernest Hancock, my good friend, Butler Schaefer. Oh, man, we got a law professor on here. Tells us all about the law and who the man is. And one thing that I want to make sure we get to before I forget is that I made some notes, and there's some things that have been rumbling around in my head. And certainly, I'm going to go on a, you know, give me a couple-minute rant here, okay, Butler?
For sure.
what I want to do is kind of preface this and get your opinion on this, because you haven't seen the movie Inception yet, and I don't want to be a spoiler for anybody. But you know, I always use movies a lot. You know, I'll use The Matrix, Braveheart, Patriot, Gladiator, V for Vendetta, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, Lord of the Rings. I mean, I'm, you know, bringing on, Brat, Wag the Dog. I mean, I all kinds of goodies. And we'll use different words and phrases and concepts. And a lot of times you can sum up an entire movie in one scene. Like Lord of the Rings, you know, you got, I don't know, what, 7-8 hours of movie there, and you just go, look, I got one scene for you. It's where Frodo tries to give the ring to Gandalf, the wizard, and he's going, no, don't tempt me further. You know, I would try to do good with the ring, but through me, through this power, you know, it would wield such evil. Boom. End mm-hmm. of movie. That's the whole movie right there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Libertarians of the Hobbits, take the Ring of Power, throw it in the fires of Mordor, problem solved, okay? In fact, just this last month, somebody sent me a clip from Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. He said the same thing.
Yeah.
He goes, hey, man, we just want to check the, you know, putting the Mount Doom. Okay, so this is my point. I see the movie Inception, where the movie's name comes from, is the inception of an idea. If in espionage, you get into someone, you get them in a dream state, and you go in and you're extracting secrets and you trick them and you know whatever, that's one thing. But to plant an idea that can be a seed that grows up, and if you can do that at a low enough level, you can change an entire life. You can change every decision they ever make. You can change the way they see and perceive every experience they ever have. You can change the person from a axiom that is part of their core. Mm-hmm. So the whole, but that's what so the whole movie is about. It's very difficult to do that. How do you do that? Blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. My daughter, 20 years old, she sees that movie. She's been, you know, 20 years. She's been, you know, immersed in this freedom oriented, doing, working, getting mom and dad's out, whatever. She sees that movie. Oh, I get it now. Because my whole point has been, it's all slogans, you know, the love-olution. In the end, freedom always wins, just gets messy first. Freedom's the answer, what's the question? I mean, you know, on and on and on and on. So what happens is I start to see, it became very clear to me, the parallel in this movie that probably nobody else saw, or certainly it's not going to be common knowledge until I make it so, is that the whole reason that they have government schools, they go from, you know, first to sixth grade, then they go to eighth grade, then they include high school. You know, they're still not able to plant the idea in someone's head that you got to share, you work for the state, your duty to the collective, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. So then they go, yeah, salute the flag. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag. A century this goes on. A century. And they spend trillions of dollars in this indoctrination of an entire culture trying to turn what used to be the American way, or the heck that was, it's not what it is now, into this service of the state. And then they go, you know, it's just not working. So we're going to go younger. We're going to go kindergarten. Then we're going to go Head Start. We're going to go mandatory, whatever, youth indoctrination, new preschool, whatever.
Year-round schools.
Yeah, year-round schools, late kindergarten, promised daycare from birth. And now here in Arizona, a few years ago, Janet Napolitano, when she was governor before she becomes, you know, head of Gestapo, she supported and got passed and signed into legislation, funded three-year-old stuff, okay? Now, it was preschool or whatever the heck it was. I am starting from this. I can see why you have ingrained in us this something that is part of our humanity. And I just had, it's 11 months since we had our first grandchild. I had my little granddaughter, Kaylee. Now I have a grandson that's going to be born next month. Mm-hmm. Now, so I'm going to have two little bit. Now, with this awareness, having raised four kids, gone through all this, you know, you get the entertainment of, you know, the progression of how, and you go, ah, ha, ha, you know, it sucks to be a parent. You do it. They're crying here. You take them. I mean, you know, so, and you get to observe this, you know, and you have fun. And she's a really great kid, so I really enjoy it. But we didn't vaccinate her or anything, and it seems like she's developing much faster. She's walking and starting to make words and everything at 10 months. So I'm going, oh, yeah, this vaccine thing, I can see, one, they want to suppress you a little bit. They want to make the you're not getting there, you know, kind of starting to use your cognitive thinking, your critical thinking. They want to delay it long enough before they can get their hands on you in the government kind of controlled system or something. So I can see the benefit of that in my conspiratorial view. Okay. The other thing is I'm going, all right, what's the first concept that a baby gets? What's the first thing? I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, I like being here. I don't like being here. I like being, you know, I like being dry. I don't like being wet. That's mom. That's dad. But we have a lot of family. So it's kind of, you know, this amorphous thing. This is the concept that I started to realize that they have to deal with. This one thing, mine. The first thing they start this screaming, God, no, you take away the bunny. Oh, heck no. Take away the blanket. Heck no. You don't let them have what they want. Give me, I got. Heck no. I mean, that's all about the parenting part. You go, whoa, 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 whoa. And you kind of do the parenting thing. But the concept of mine, that is one of the earliest things of self-awareness. And you can say, you see this thing I'm holding on right here? This thing that I like, this thing that I want, this thing right here? It's freaking mine. Yep. And they have to beat that out of us. They have to delay the development of that, and they have to supplant it with something else, or they mm-hmm. lose us forever with the concept of mine, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, I think this is also why children who are raised in what I would call essentially a libertarian, I mean this in the broad sense of the word, libertarian environment, catch on to it so quickly, because it's consistent with their understanding, their nature, what it means to be a kid. If you're in there thwarting a kid at every stage at which he or she wants to do something, pretty soon you've developed a pretty screwed up kid, you know, all these contradictions and conflicts and so forth. And our girls were all raised in Montessori schools, and our grandchildren are now being raised that way. And Montessori schools operate on the premise that it's a child-centered kind of classroom. And what we're concerned with is how little Johnny or little Sally or someone, where they are at this point in their development, and can we introduce something to them that might be of some additional interest to them, as opposed to having 35 little kids in a classroom, and you're indoctrinating them into, you know, the statist point of view, you know, with George Washington's picture at the front of the classroom and the flag and all this sort of stuff. And it's, the government schools, my wife, Jane, has raised the point, I think, quite well, that we should stop calling them public schools. They're not public schools, they're government schools, exist primarily for the purpose of, as I think it was H.L. Mencken said, to have you want the society the way it's presently organized. You know, you just can't think of it in any other way. And kids grow up this way. I get them in law school. It's just, you know, what? How else could we do it other than this way? You know, if you want to resolve some kind of a problem, why, you put it up to a democratic vote, and that's the way you do it. You know, it's just, you know, it's a matter of helping people even before they become adults. I think that this is something that you develop quite early on. By the time they become adults, it's much more difficult to get them to break outside that circle, because the circle is who they are. That's how they define themselves. They think of themselves in terms of everything that's contained within the circle that they've learned in the school system and churches and the media and their parents and friends and so forth.
Well, tell me, what is it you think that, I mean, if I was let's put it this way. It's throughout human history and time, this got figured out thousands of years ago. There's, you know, the Prince by Machiavelli. I mean, you know, there's, the advisors to Solomon. The pharaohs had their priests sitting around, rubbing their hands together going, I mean, you know, they're human beings really have not changed that much, and certainly the past few thousand years, or even 10,000 or 100,000 years. I mean, it's we may have been able to make greater use of our brains, or we were using them in a different way. We were more open to nature. We were using it, contemplating, God or the stars or whatever the heck we were doing, or sitting there, listening to the wind or something. But the point is that human beings having the capacity to think, I'm thinking it's not a lot different than it was 5,000 years ago. So if you have in human history somebody that has, they created the farm, man. I mean, we got people be productive doing this oxen agricultural Nile, making papyrus paper we can write it down on, and wheat or rice or whatever we can eat with, and we got a whole bunch of slaves. And they're sitting there thinking how best to do it. Well, they got their little book, De La whatever, and it gets passed down and passed down and passed down. Now it doesn't even get, need to be dusted off. They never put it up on the shelf. They're constantly using the same kind of control mechanism to get us in service of anything but ourselves. Mm-hmm. It is always for somebody else, for something else, using whatever commercial, cleavage, leg, we want, save save the animal, kind of whatever the heck excuse that they're doing to get us to do. So now I'm not for being a bad steward of your property or the planet or your environment or any of that stuff. It just happens a lot more often when it's not collectively owned and somebody actually owns it and you're protecting property rights. But so this is my question. In that concept, you get the millennia rolls on, you get different organizations that retain and forward this information, and they get secret handshakes, and they got their little clubhouse and whatever. And I'm wondering, what is it that they, at the core, you think is their goal? What for to maintain the control, and they get deep, that idea that they have to plant, they want to, you know, postpone the development in an infant. They want to get to them as young as possible so they can wire us or attempt to and use chemicals. You know, pharmaceutical companies, you know, what goes into the water, what kind of, you know, food additives you get, whatever it freaking takes. As my teenagers, when they were in at home in the bathroom, I walk in the morning and there's this freaking Axe spray fog along with all their other chemical and crap they're smearing all over their body and in their mouth. And I'm going, you know, I'm wondering, what is it? If they can, they are. That's my point. You know, we got bad guys need to be bad, and they want to do something, maintain and enhance and expand their intrusiveness and control over the planet. You know, if they can do it, they are. I just need to know, can they? Well, then they are. Mm-hmm. What is it at the base that they have to do to change a human being into a battery for the machine? In your estimation, what is the primary thing they got
to
do?
I think that the people who want to essentially use other people, they're exploiting people in the very realistic sense of the word, exploiting people for the purpose, I think, essentially just wanting power. I think power becomes kind of an end in itself that may be reflective of something else I've talked and written about, and that has to do with the need that I think all of us have for what I call religious or spiritual experiences. And I mean that with a small r and a small s. I'm not talking about any particular church or anything like that. And in fact, I think in many cases, as Carl Jung once said, you know, we have these needs for spiritual experiences, but churches are the last place you're probably going to have them. And we get them in a variety of ways. You know, we get them by being inventors, by writing things, by raising children well, by various means, some of which historically have been the quest for power, the quest for status, the quest for fame, the quest for riches. You know, somehow or other, if I have all of this, I'll be able to transcend my own lonely self. I'll be able to be something greater than just Butler Schaefer. You know, I'll be remembered as, you know, Julius Caesar or somebody like this. And I think it's this need to extend power over other people, over the universe in some fashion, as a way of kind of glorifying yourself is what is.
No, I can see the motivation. I'm just wondering, you know, if you got one word, one thing, I got to, you know, punch him in the face at, you know, 2.5 months old. I got to, pinch him in the butt at every time they take a bite of Spam. I mean, there's got to be, you know, either a mechanism for do it or a goal or something that they want to implant, that it's always bad to say mine. Bam, a spanking. You say mine because some people are like that. No, there is no yours. You they are raised that way. They have people that are raised. You must share with your 14 brothers and sisters. I mean, there's something that's at the core that you can change a human being into something totally different.
And it has nothing to do with the immediate objective. I remember many years ago, well, not many for me, but probably not for the others, when urban renewal was a really important thing. We've got to go in and tear down these old parts of the town and rebuild. It was basically a racket for
developers,
the builders, and so forth, but we'll overlook that for the moment. But that was what sold this, was the idea we're going to make this, you know, a better community, a better city, by tearing down all these old, ugly, dilapidated buildings and putting up new high-rise apartments and so forth. And people bought into that.
Well, you know, let's hold off. You know, it's right there. They're going to push the button on us, Butler. So we'll do urban renewal. Go ahead and remember where you're at. I'll mark it down here and remind you. And we'll pick it up from right there when we come back on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my good friend, Butler Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Wait for it. Here it comes. Yes, I'm talking about here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Butler Schaefer, constitutional law professor that's going to, you know, he's going to learnify us. And we got another hour with him. We're going to have us all kinds of fun. And the one thing that we want to pick right up where we left off, it's a short segment here, then another short segment at the top of the hour when we come back, and then we start getting the longer ones. And we were talking about urban renewal. Back in the day, they're going, you know, we got to tear down all of this and rebuild new, and because, you know, we are so hollow and void inside that we're going to feel better if we have new bricks around us. Is that it?
That became the politically correct stance within cities. You got to tear down all these old buildings and build up new ones because new is always better than old, right? Well, after that became rather revealed to be a kind of a cozy racket for some special interests who were promoting it, it was difficult to support it, particularly when it became rather clear that these urban renewal programs were a major contributor to the breakdown of life in the inner cities. You know, a lot of the street corner gang activity that we see in cities, much of it, not all of it, but much of it can be traced back to these types of programs that just destroyed the structure of the inner cities. So now, the same people that were promoting urban renewal are in promoting the importance of conserving historic buildings. So at one point in time, we've got to destroy all these buildings. Now we've got to save them. But it's the same people, it's the same purpose. We want the power to decide what the city's going to look like. And whether we're going to destroy old buildings or we're going to save them, we'll decide.
Wow. And the result has been what? Just confusion?
Well, come into most cities and you see. You know, it's...
I know what's going on here in Phoenix. There's developers and builders, and light rail is the big thing now. I mean, and it's just some of the guys with the pull making all the money. And it's just an enormous boondoggle here. They did light rail. We made such a big deal out of it. And it all came down to, you know, it's we're going to have an election, or we're going to elect people that will vote it, or we're going to have, you know, a computer-counted de la whatever, and it's going to be 51-49, and we're going to spend billions of dollars. And I'm going, you know, they wouldn't do election fraud. That'd be wrong. And I'm going, mm-hmm. It controls trillions of dollars in this country.
We're going to have an election to decide whether or not the city of Phoenix should build a new baseball stadium.
Football stadium, basketball stadium.
And they had it anyway.
Well, the thing is that's where, you know, in the next hour we're going to get into this, is that, you know, should I advocate being able to vote anything where I'm going to be taking with a 45 to somebody's head their property to do the great, wonderful urban renewal, downtown revitalization, public housing, park, library, basketball, midnight basketball
whatever.
Court, whatever. This is where we have already gone down this road. How far do we need to go down this road before, you know, it gets dark and slippery and slimy and infected and kind of, I mean, and produces so much? Is there, if I keep going further or faster, all of a sudden there's a light down at the end or something?
Mm-hmm.
When does that happen? Well, I tell you, you know, Butler Schaefer is right now experiencing an entire new generation that is coming up with the understanding that it's not working the way MTV Rockin' the Vote says it's supposed to. You go to junior high, and they tell you that's why you have junior high. That's why you have seventh and eighth grade. It's right when you start through puberty, right when you start to question authority. They're going to tell you, okay, let me tell you how you question authority. You go vote. Wow. Oh, we're going to talk about that and repudiation of the debt when we come back on Declare Your Independence.